final push to win over some very unlikely supporters, Republicans. And to do that, she's hitting the campaign trail with prominent GOP figures like former Congresswoman Liz Cheney.
You have to choose in this race between someone who has been faithful to the Constitution, who will be faithful, and Donald Trump.
NPR correspondents Sarah McCammon and Susan Davis have been reporting on these efforts and join us now. Hey to both of you.
Hey, Elsa.
Hi there.
Hi. Okay, Sarah, let's start with you. What exactly is the case that the campaign is making here?
So the phrase I've been hearing over and over again for months as I've been covering these efforts to win over Republicans for Harris's campaign is permission structure. And, you know, this is predicated on the idea that there are some voters out there who see themselves as conservative or Republican, may have consistently voted for Republicans in the past, but are looking for a reason and permission to vote differently this time around, especially after January 6th. And the message to these voters has been heavily focused on the idea of protecting democracy, on the idea that Trump poses a grave threat to American institutions. And to do that, they have relied on trusted messengers to make that case, like former Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who we just heard.
Right. And it's not just Cheney who's helping them, right?
Right. Just this week, local Republican officials in Wisconsin endorsed Harris, as did former Michigan Republican Congressman Fred Upton. Plus, she's been appearing with dozens of former Republicans who've endorsed her, including former members of Congress and former Trump administration officials. And these Republican supporters of Harris will say things like, look, we can argue about things like tax brackets later on. The objective now is to keep Trump from being elected again. Vice President Harris's campaign has announced that she will be making her closing arguments to voters next week on Tuesday at the Ellipse in D.C., an event that's intended to remind voters about January 6th.
Right. And Sue, you were in Pennsylvania this week. So I'm wondering, how is that messaging that Sarah's talking about right now resonating with voters there?
Well, first, Elsa, consider a little math. Pennsylvania is one of those states where Democrats think they can make an appeal here because earlier this year, nearly 160,000 Republicans, it was a closed primary, voted for South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley in the Republican primary. And that was well after she had dropped out of the race. Huh. And this is a state that Joe Biden won in 2020 with about 80,000 votes.
Yeah.
But I will tell you, these voters are hard to find. I was at that Cheney event earlier in the week. I spoke to a handful of voters. They said, oh, I'm an independent, but when I them. They had a history of voting consistently Democratic. That's not exactly the swing voter that Kamala Harris is looking for. I also spent time knocking doors with Americans for Prosperity. That's a conservative group that backed Haley in the primary and has not endorsed Trump and is focused on down ballot turnout. Every voter we came across was voting straight Republican ticket.
Okay, well then, did you find any swing voters?
Okay, they do exist. We did find one.
Okay.
Our colleagues at WQLN in Erie, Pennsylvania spoke to Joshua McGee. He's 22. He's a graduate student. He voted for Trump in 2020, and he said he's just recently made up his mind after attending a women's rally for abortion rights.
I didn't truly understand until after that how much women will suffer at the hands of Donald Trump if he is elected in 2024. And, I know for certain that Kamala Harris will support women and support everyone for that matter. And I know Donald Trump does not support people that go against him.
Young male, 2020 Republican voter, exactly the type of margin the Harris campaign is looking to chip away at.
Sure. Okay. Well, Sarah, I am curious about the other side of things. Is the Trump campaign trying to poach Democratic voters? And if so, like, who are those people?
You know, the Trump campaign isn't doing what the Harris campaign is doing. They're not running some kind of concerted effort to appeal to the other party. But there is polling that suggests that this is happening organically with growing support for Trump among Black and Latino men, for instance. So Trump could also benefit from some small measure of Democratic crossover, too, from traditional Democratic voting blocs. The Trump campaign all along has been focused on turning out its base. There's been no real effort to appeal to political centrists, aside from a couple of comments Trump has made that appeared to try to soften his stance on opposition to abortion. But for the most part, he has appealed to his base. The campaign has projected confidence that those Nikki Haley primary voters that Sue mentioned will ultimately come home and vote for the Republican nominee. And Haley herself has, of course, endorsed Trump, though she hasn't campaigned for him much beyond that.
And look, there's a reason that the Trump campaign might be confident that Harris might not be able to eat too much into his margins. When the country's living through a supercharged, polarized election environment just like this one, the crossover vote is going to be pretty minimal. I spoke to Lee Mieringhoff. He's the polling director at Marist College, which is NPR's polling partner. And he said it's pretty hard for one party to pick up support in enemy territory.
And having said that, anything you pick up cross party lines is, in a close race, could be a huge factor. So it's, and on the one hand, don't look for double digit pickups across party lines. But if you're running 7 or 8%, I mean, that's like huge potentially.
And if this race is coming down to tight margins in those 7 swing states and all directions point to that, then those tiny movements for either campaign could have a major impact.
Indeed. That is NPR's Susan Davis and Sarah McCammon. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Both Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump have been courting swing voters in Pennsylvania, a self-proclaimed must-win state for both campaigns that polls show is evenly split between the candidates. One big political challenge for Harris is inflation. A Pew Research Center poll out last month found that 8 in 10 registered voters said the economy is their top issue in the election. Robert Benincasa from NPR's Investigations Unit visited the city of Pittsburgh to talk with voters about rising grocery prices and their choices in the election.
There's nothing like a trip to the grocery store to remind you of inflation.
We're charging $4 for the white eggs, which are grocery store eggs. We've been charging $6.25 a dozen for the brown farm eggs from our farmer.
Diane Schenk owns Dilamato's Market, a small, successful grocery store in Pittsburgh's Hazelwood neighborhood, a place where big supermarkets aren't within walking distance. In Pittsburgh, the price of eggs is up nearly 40% in the last year. That's among the highest across the nation's 50 top metro areas. NPR reached out to Data Assembly Incorporated, a market intelligence company that tracks billions of grocery item prices every week. They gave us a year's worth of grocery price data for places all over the country, including Pittsburgh. Prices for fish and poultry here have dropped, even as beef and pork are up by 4 to 5%. And the impact on Steelers fans' tailgate parties has been minimal. The price of beer is up only 2%. Nationally, grocery prices have been cooling. They're up a bit over 1% in the last year. But that's after an increase of more than a quarter since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. So your $100 grocery bill in early 2020 is now about $126. Yadora Diamond, a former Hazelwood resident who returned to shop at Schenk's store, chatted with me as Schenk's husband rang up her order of fresh produce and sandwiches. She believes her grocery bill will be lower if former President Trump is elected, because she thinks he'll be better for fuel prices and farmers.
Even though he believes in the trickle-down effect, I just know how it was when he was in office. Financially, I was much better.
That sentiment is shared broadly by many Americans, according to polls. Just down the street, Bruce and Emily Thornton own the 111 Juice Bar, which offers cold-pressed fruits and vegetables. They've seen the cost of their ingredients increase. Bruce says he disagrees with some Biden administration policies and will reluctantly vote for Kamala Harris.
The reason why she's getting my vote is because I think it'll be a little better. I don't know, for us than the alternative. Well, she says she's willing to tax the upper class, and I believe that that is necessary. There needs to be a real tax on people who are making all this money, and then everyone else is kind of hurting.
The trouble with inflation numbers is that they aren't the only thing that can drive political attitudes. There's also the perception of inflation. A few years ago, Harvard Business School economist Alberto Cavallo scanned the receipts of shoppers outside grocery stores in Argentina, which was reeling from high inflation. He compared their beliefs about inflation to the real inflation rates affecting what they bought.
People do seem to put a lot of emphasis on the prices of things that they can connect to, so things that are in their basket. No, they seem to have these memories about the price increases, and that's what essentially drives their expectations of inflation.
The problem?
their memories are really bad.
Cavallo found that shoppers often overestimated increases in the prices of their products and underestimated past prices. Back in Pittsburgh's Dilamato's Market, Schenck hears about grocery prices from her customers every day. But she says they've been showing some restraint when it comes to politics.
We don't have people going off about stuff they'd like to, but they kind of catch themselves and they're like, oh, well, you know, we're not going to talk politics.
At least not at the grocery store. Robert Benincasa, NPR News.
After winning 7 Super Bowls as a player, former NFL quarterback Tom Brady signed a 9-figure deal to be a TV commentator. Then he bought a stake in an NFL team, setting up a potential conflict of interest. How might Tom Brady have his team and talk about it too? That story on tomorrow's All Things Considered. If you aren't by your radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 91.3 FM in Junction City. We are always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello. Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu.
Stay tuned. Coming up in our next half hour, an Israeli airstrike this morning killed and injured some journalists. We'll tell you what we know. The latest news coming right up. Also, police in Virginia released their report on the incident at Arlington Cemetery. Tom Bowman will tell us more about it. We'll also learn about a very important comic book auction coming up on KPR.
Don't let your aging RV take you for a ride. KPR's vehicle donation program will gladly take it off your hands so we can help fund the news and music programming you enjoy. Donate your car, truck, boat, or RV online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Every day you hear the difference on KPR. In-depth news, thoughtful civil conversations. Our news coverage is only made possible, however, by listeners like you. More than 84% of KPR's operating budget comes from private support. Now more than ever, it's the time to invest in KPR and the news that matters. Now's the time to discover how you can make a difference and contribute now at support.kansaspublicradio.org. And thank you very much. Mostly clear skies tonight with a low down in the mid-30s. Tomorrow, sunny with a high in the mid-60s. It's 63 degrees in Lawrence, 65 in Manhattan, and it is 620.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie, Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Nash County, North Carolina. Where Alex Cook, Adon Bermudez Bay, and other door knockers have spotted a registered voter. A voter getting into his black SUV to drive away, sure, but a voter nonetheless. They spring into action.
Hey, how you doing? Did we get 5 minutes of your time? 5 minutes.
It'll be worth it.
It'll be worth it.
That voter, Ja'Kai Britton, says no, he's got to run. He's off to the airport. But to this organizing team, the stakes for 2024, and in this state especially, are too high to let Britain go just yet.
3 minutes.
It's important. It's going to change your life.
2 minutes.
Yay, we got it, we got it.
And they're in. Britain, who is registered as a non-affiliated voter, says he's not planning on casting a ballot this year. Cook, from the organizing group Down Home North Carolina, starts peppering him with questions about the issues he's facing in his life.
You need health care, though, right? You get SSI, yes. So you need your health care.
Yes. I get SSI.
So do we have a vote for you? All right, let me give you some of this literature, sir.
From driving away to a conversation, from a no on voting to a maybe, all in the span of just a couple minutes.
Do you think he was just being polite to end the conversation, or do you think that's a vote?
I think it's a vote, because if he, at first he was saying no, but once he realized that his Social Security can be affected from this, and his health care can be affected, and he's saying he got a mom in there, so I know she needs health care.
Down Home North Carolina is a nonprofit organizing in rural communities across the state. They say their platform is survival, helping poor and working class people get basic needs met, like housing and education. In an election season like this one, they're mostly focused on local races, but they endorse candidates up and down the ticket, usually Democrats. Most of their time is spent urging residents, especially residents of color, to get out and vote.
We can't answer the door right now. But if you'd like to leave a message, you can do it now.
They don't open the door all the time, so 1 out of 10 doors, you might get someone.
And they typically face other challenges. There's a lot of walking in pretty hot weather, even in this time of year. And two different times while we tag along with them, despite no laws being broken, patrol cars from the county sheriff linger near the organizers.
There's some police coming.
Oh, they caught the police are done.
Nash County is in a rural part of this key swing state. It's near evenly divided between white and black residents. In the recent presidential elections, it was near evenly divided by its results. President Joe Biden won the county by 0.2 of a point in 2020. 4 years before that, former President Donald Trump won it by the exact same razor-thin margin. But driving around the tiny town of Nashville, where they're canvassing today, it doesn't feel that way. There are Trump signs everywhere, a mix of homemade and official, plus plenty of MAGA flags. Still, Bermudez Bay and his team of volunteers are finding all of these Democratic doors to knock on.
What I notice is that there's a lot of people want to stay out the way. They see the Trump signs. They see what's going on in school boards, city council. They're just like, I'm going to stay out of it. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to tell them, like, there's an organization that specifically focuses in rural areas to pull those folks out, those who are hesitant.
This is the exact type of work that North Carolina State Democratic Chair Anderson Clayton says is crucial to building up the party's competitiveness in the Tar Heel state.
The single most powerful form of voter suppression is gerrymandering, like in any case scenario, because it makes people feel like their votes don't matter.
We talked to Clayton a few days before heading to Nash County. North Carolina has some of the most extreme partisan-drawn maps in the nation. The state has a Democratic governor in office, but Republicans hold a supermajority in the state house. Clayton, who's 26 and from rural Person County, has made reaching out to rural Democrats a key part of her strategy.
Joe Biden lost this state by 74,000 votes in 2020, which we know is a field margin, and that can come from all of our counties across the state.
That means juicing up turnout in the cities and suburbs, sure, but it also means convincing Democrats in more rural areas that their vote matters, that it's worth it to show up at the polls. It matters to the results, even if those extra votes are on the margins, because North Carolina has more rural voters than any other 2024 presidential swing state.
I'm not going to win rural North Carolina this year. Like, I'm trying to break back margins in it. There's a difference in talking or trying to talk to rural voters and talking to rural Democrats, and you need to do one before you do the other. And I'm like, I'm trying to talk to rural Democrats this year, people that showed up in 2008 that ain't showed up since because they haven't had somebody to vote for, and they didn't feel like their vote actually mattered.
Back in Nashville, Down Home door knockers make their pitch to another potential voter.
Here are the candidates that we have endorsed: Josh Stein.
Sean Jones tells us he plans on voting, though in the presidential race, he hasn't quite made up his mind. He's leaning toward Vice President Kamala Harris.
I just recently went to go see my brother in prison this weekend, and he was kind of like on my head about it, like voting. He wanted me to vote for Trump, but I still wanted to vote for Kamala, so like, I'm still trying to, like, look into the politics as far as, like, what's what and who's who.
With 2 weeks to go before Election Day, finding a true undecided voter feels like a rarity. But Jones actually isn't the only voter we meet who tells us he's still unsure. Adon Bermudez Bay, Down Home's regional field director, fits that bill, even though he's leading this group of canvassers who have endorsed Harris.
I don't know if I'm voting for Kamala yet, just full transparency, but I know that I'm definitely not voting for Trump.
Speaking just for himself, Bermudez Bay says he has concerns about Harris, her time as a prosecutor in California, her support for Israel during the ongoing war in the Middle East. He set a deadline for himself, November 2nd, the last day of early voting in North Carolina. That's when he'll decide between Harris or a third-party candidate. In the meantime, though, his pragmatic political side sees the merits of a Harris presidency, at least for Down Home's work.
No, it's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be a lot easier for us to organize under her presidency than Trump's.
That general feeling, the motivation of voting against Trump rather than for Harris, is in the air a dozen miles away at an early voting site in Rocky Mount, Nash County.
I just feel like Donald Trump is for billionaires and not for working class people.
Lynn Jones has just cast her ballot. She's walking back to the car with her neighbor, Donnell Jones, no relation, who has just voted for the very first time in his life.
No reason, I just didn't. That's all. No big issue about it. I just didn't ever do it.
Lynn says the two of them had a series of conversations in recent weeks about him joining her to vote.
I just thought, you know, he was at an age where this just should have happened a lot sooner, but I know sometimes people are stuck in their ways, so I didn't pressure him. Just, hey, let's go vote together then.
And the result?
I voted for the lady.
Was one more vote in the bank for Harris. If Democrats are going to win Nash County and win North Carolina, it's going to be through thousands of interactions like what Down Home is doing, and what, on a more casual level, Lynn Jones did with Donnell Jones, nudging others to show up and vote, regardless of how disengaged or skeptical they were at the beginning of those conversations. On tomorrow's All Things Considered, we look at a key part of Trump's coalition in North Carolina, conservative Christian voters, and talk to a Raleigh pastor about why they've stuck with Trump through all the years, as our series, We the Voters, continues.
This is NPR News.
North Carolina is seen by many as a must-win state for Donald Trump. A key part of his constituency there, conservative Christians.
You can have some people with some pretty deep moral struggles who are upholding a platform that we support.
One North Carolina religious leader on why Trump's support from conservative Christians runs so deep. That's on All Things Considered.
Join us tomorrow afternoon beginning at 4 o'clock on your KPR stations for Weekend All Things Considered.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.
Stay with us. News headlines are coming up next. It's 63 degrees in Lawrence, 62 in Atchison, 69 in Chanute. It is 6:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Coming up, a new exhibit explores the groundbreaking path of Belle DaCosta Green.
She was the first director of New York's Morgan Library.
There's not only the racial issues she was up against, but the gender ones as well. I mean, she becomes director very shortly after women gained the right to vote.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Biden gave an emotional apology today to the Native American community for how the government treated them in the past, Biden calling it a blot on American history, speaking at the Gila River Indian Reservation where government-run boarding schools separated children from their parents. It was part of a forced assimilation program that wiped out identities, languages, and culture in the process.
After 150 years, the United States government eventually stop the program. But the federal government has never, never formally apologized for what happened. until today. I formally apologize as President of the United States of America for what we did. I formally apologize.
Democrats are hoping Biden's visit also provides a boost to the Harris campaign's turnout effort in another key battleground state. At least 10 Pakistani security personnel have died in a shootout with militants in the country's restive northwest province. NPR's Omkar Khandekar reports.
Police sources told NPR that dozens of militants attacked security personnel outposts in the town of Dera Ismail Khan on Thursday night. An Interior Ministry spokesperson said that the militants carried heavy weapons and used the cover of darkness to their advantage. The attack, claimed by the Islamist group Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan, comes as Pakistan battles a resurgence of militant attacks in the province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa near the border. Pakistan alleges that the group operates out of sanctuaries in Afghanistan with the support of its Taliban government. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News.
Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street as companies continue to report mostly solid profits from the last quarter. The Dow. This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. More cases have been reported in an outbreak of E. coli linked to McDonald's restaurants. The Centers for Disease Control says 26 new illnesses have been reported, bringing the total to 75 cases across 13 states, including Kansas and Missouri. So far, one person has died, 22 have been hospitalized. The CDC says most people in this outbreak had consumed quarter-pounder hamburgers at McDonald's before becoming sick. It is not yet known which specific food ingredient is contaminated. Fire season has arrived in Kansas. Yesterday, firefighters battled a 300-acre grass fire in northeast Wichita. KAKE-TV reports that no one was hurt. The cause of that fire is unknown. The large grass fire in Sedgwick County was one of just many around the state this week. KSNW-TV reports that crews battled other grass fires in Sumner, Chase, and Finney counties. Kansas wildlife officials hope to block an invasive carp from moving upstream of a dam in Lawrence. The Bowersock Dam on the Kansas River is a relatively low one, and it turns out that silver carp are excellent jumpers. When the river is high, they could leap over the hydroelectric dam. So the Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks is planning to install a kind of grate. Liam Odell is a biologist with the agency.
The way I can describe it is it would kind of be like these metal fingers will come off of that north powerhouse where we're worried about them potentially jumping over, and those will prevent them from being able to get that, achieve enough height to go into the other side.
Wildlife officials want to block this species because it's a prolific spawner that grows fast and competes with native fish for food. Dr. Roy Menninger, the grandson of the man who founded the Menninger Clinic, has died at the age of 97. He's the former CEO of the Menninger Foundation and served as chair of the foundation's board of trustees until 2003 when the Menninger Clinic moved to Baylor. Along with his wife, Beb, Menninger served as co-chair of the KPR advisory board for many years. The family is suggesting memorial donations to Doctors Without Borders in lieu of flowers. Lows in the mid-30s tonight at 62 degrees in Lawrence at 6:35.
Word for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Three journalists were killed by Israeli airstrikes in Lebanon today. The guest house where they had been staying with other journalists came under attack in the early morning. NPR's Arzu Rizvani spoke with one of them who survived the airstrikes.
The journalists would spend their days in southern Lebanon, pretty much at the front lines of the war between Hezbollah and Israeli forces. They'd spend their nights at a guest house in the small town of Husbaya, away from the fighting. It felt safe there. It had become a refuge for many journalists from international news organizations, including Sky News Arabia and Al Jazeera, and it hadn't been a target of Israeli airstrikes before. The journalists made sure their cars were clearly labeled press, and as an added precaution, many had also given their whereabouts to UN peacekeepers, who are typically in contact with Israeli military. Hassan Hotate of Al Qaira News was among the group of journalists. He said after a long day, many had turned in early for the night. And then, at 3 a.m., it happened.
I woke up to the sound of loud rattling and glass shattering, and suddenly I felt a great weight upon my body. I couldn't move. I couldn't move at all. And I thought this is the moment that could be the moment of my death.
Other surviving journalists pulled Hotate out from under the rubble, but cameraman Ghassan Najjar, camera operator Wissam Ghassem, and engineer Mohammed Ridda were all killed. They worked for broadcasters Al-Manar, a network operated by Hezbollah, and Al-Mayadeen, a pro-Iran, pro-Palestinian news channel. Hotate believes Israel is going after journalists for their coverage of this war, here in Lebanon and in Gaza. And he believes Israel's military has free rein to do so.
With Israel, there are no normal rules of engagement. They say when you are fighting an enemy, leave them a path to retreat so that they don't become vicious. Israel has no respect for that, even though they have superiority. They struck us while we were sleeping. But those who massacred children, it's easy for them to kill journalists.
Hotate is now recovering from his injuries at a hospital in Beirut. He has the TV on. It's turned to the news. He's watching coverage of the very airstrike he survived. Lebanon's information minister said the attack was deliberate and called the deaths a war crime. Israel's military says it hit a Hezbollah military structure in the same town where Hotate and the others were attacked today. It said it later learned that journalists were among the casualties and added, quote, the incident is under review. Arzu Rezvani, NPR News, Beirut.
The WNBA is wrapping up a historic year. In-game attendance and viewership all reached record highs, and the buzz around the league is louder than ever. The salaries of players, however, don't seem to match that success.
Yes, I want to opt out.
The WNBA, you know, if you want us to be here, you have to pay us more. It's business.
Everyone, buckle up. It's about to be a fun day.
This is our opportunity to get it right.
And that is why this week, just a day after the end of the season, the league's labor union decided to opt out of its current collective bargaining agreement that runs through 2027. Players are asking for higher wages, improved benefits, and a larger share of the media rights deal it shares with the NBA. Nneka Ogumike is a forward with the Seattle Storm and the president of the Women's National Basketball Players Association. That's the players' union that represents the league. We asked her about that deal specifically and what she thought about the WNBA's share.
Well, I mean, it's certainly groundbreaking in that it greatly surpasses any media deals we've had before. I'm hoping that it doesn't limit what we can also, how we can also market and brand ourselves as the WNBA as we continue to sustain through this unique growth that the WNBA is having. But as you know, with the numbers that are being thrown out, we're going to want to be able to share in that value, share in that growth. And I look forward to seeing how the intricacies of a deal like that can be reflected in how we compensate the players as well.
Does having a bigger piece of the pie create a future where the WNBA's revenue is less dependent on the success of another league? Specifically, we're talking about the NBA here.
You know, I mean, we can never ignore the great support that we get from the NBA. But I do love that, you know, the WNBA is forming its own path and sustaining itself. And, you know, as big as both leagues are, and as similar as you can find them to be, the difference is what really makes us very special. And I'm excited to know that we are getting opportunities and investment that are unique to us. And I look forward to seeing how much we can really make that exponential growth.
A work stoppage is possible if talks fall through, and that would be a first for the league. With all of the progress that's been made this year, what would that mean for the momentum that the WNBA has going into next season?
Well, you know, I mean, with all of the attention and the visibility that we have on the WNBA today, you know, even with the conclusion of this season, there's so much movement and so many changes as people are really experiencing this surge and this excitement. You know, we're looking forward to an expansion draft. And I think at the conclusion of the 2025 season, there will continue to be eyes on us, even in the offseason, especially as we renegotiate in anticipation of the 2026 season. So, you know, work stoppage is by far not what we hope for, but it's something that we definitely prepare for. But we are really seeking a very collaborative negotiation that can land the players where we feel like our value is met.
The amount of growth that the WNBA has seen in this year and the last couple of years has really been astronomical. Do you worry at all that there is a risk that the growth that we've seen isn't sustainable?
I don't worry about that at all. I think that we've been in a space where what the public is feeling and seeing is something that we've always known. And this new era is just us realizing that people see us for what we are. I'm just excited to be a part of it. I'm excited to be actively playing while this is happening so I can use my platform and leadership in ways to contribute to this historical moment.
Nneka, you have called these negotiations a defining moment for the WNBA. What do you think that the decisions that are being made by leadership right now will mean both for future generations of players, but also future fan bases?
I mean, we're really in a transformational moment. You know, I think that today we have players that are fighting for the fair share of the business that we built. You know, there is no product without the players. And we know that our success is the league's success. We know our business. We know we are a part of this business, and we want to be a part of the generational growth of this business so we can leave this league better than when we entered it.
Nneka Ogwumike is a forward with the Seattle Storm and the president of the WNBA Players Association. Nneka, thank you.
Thank you.
If you're a regular listener of All Things Considered or our sister podcast, Consider This, you can now check out the Consider This newsletter. We help you break down one major story of the day, but you'll also get to know our producers, our hosts, and some fun stories from the All Things Considered team. You can sign up at npr.org/consider this newsletter. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In the early 2000s, Vermont resident Christine Farrell amassed a collection of everything published by DC Comics. She's believed to be the first person to have achieved this feat. Her collection of more than 30,000 comics begins in 1935 and features the first appearances of heroes like Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. Farrell died in April, and as Vermont Public's Liam Elder Connors reports, some of the rarest comics in her collection will now be sold.
Christine Farrell started reading comic books when she was a kid and began her collection in her teenage years. In 1995, Farrell took Mountain Lake PBS on a tour of her house where she kept her collection. Comics were piled in overflowing banker's boxes and stacked on the floor. It was messy, but there appeared to be some organization. In the video, Farrell pulled a comic from a container labeled Wonder Woman, issues 121 to 145.
This one, I paid a whopping 12 cents for. It was 1963 at the time.
At first, Farrell says she favored comics with female leads, like Lois Lane and Supergirl. But soon, she says she was buying all of them.
I'm a pack rat. I didn't know it until I turned into a teenager, but pack rats are born, not made, and apparently I was born a pack rat.
In the early 1980s, Farrell opened a comic book shop in Burlington, Vermont's largest city. But as she told Mountain Lake PBS, she collected the comics because she was a fan.
I buy them because I want to read them, although my reading is about 10 years behind, but not for resale, not at all. I do not intend to sell the collection.
But now, after Farrell's death, about 500 of her rarest comics will go to the highest bidders this weekend. Dallas, Texas-based Heritage Auctions is handling the sale. Vice President Lon Allen estimates this weekend's auction could bring in $4 million, with Superman's 1938 debut likely to fetch the highest price. Allen says the collection contains other rarities too, like one called Double Action Comics. There are only 7 copies known to still exist.
It's so steeped in mystery, nobody really understands what it is or where it came from. So it's something that's just impossible to value.
It's comics like that that make Farrell's collection so special to Stephen Bissett, a Vermonter and comic book artist. His work includes illustrating Swamp Thing in the 1980s during writer Alan Moore's run on the series. For Bissett, it's not the monetary value that matters. It's the artistic and creative history that's contained in the thousands of comics Farrell collected.
Chris had every issue of their science fiction comics. Strange Adventures, House of Secrets, Challenges of the Unknown. I mean, these are titles that don't register with the public at large. But they had amazing stories, and that's where, to me, the creative juices are.
The auction this weekend is focused on the older and more high-end comics in Farrell's collection. The rest will likely be sold at Farrell's comic book store, Earth Prime Comics. For NPR News, I'm Liam Elder Connors in Burlington, Vermont.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Hi, KPR friends. It's Destiny from Evening Classical inviting you to the closer for Live Day. You can meet me and my friends. I am actually playing the violin Spooky Sounds for you. October 25th, Friday, 7 p.m., Lawrence Public Library. It's free. I would so love to meet all of you. See you for this spooky time, Friday, October 25th, 7 p.m., Lawrence Public Library.
That is tonight. It begins in literally 12 minutes. You still got time to get down to the library. If you don't have time to get down to the library, stick around on your KPR1 stations. You will hear it live, the grand finale of Live Day.
Support for KPR comes from Blue Collar Press. Located in Lawrence, Kansas, Blue Collar Press helps businesses and creatives build their brands through merchandising, from design to production to fulfillment. More information at bluecollarpress.com.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 96.1 FM in Lawrence, many non-Lawrence frequencies as well, all across the state. You can listen online anytime at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Eagles Rest, the locally owned furniture store in Lawrence, specializing in toxin-free customizable mattresses by Savvy Rest. All natural latex, wool, and cotton with a 20-year warranty. Online at eaglesrestnaturalhome.com.
Mostly clear skies tonight with a low in the mid-30s. Tomorrow, sunshine and a high in the mid-60s. Down to the lower 40s tomorrow night, highs in the mid-70s for Sunday. Back up into the mid to upper 80s for Monday. Then cooling off again. These roller coaster temperatures just not leaving us alone. It is 61 degrees in Lawrence at 10 minutes before 7.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Army today released a police report concerning an altercation between 2 Trump campaign staffers and an employee at Arlington National Cemetery. The incident took place back in August. That day, Donald Trump laid a wreath commemorating the 3rd anniversary of the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the 13 U.S. service members who were killed by a terrorist bomb. NPR's Tom Bowman joins us in the studio now. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Juana.
So, Tom, I know you broke back in August. Why is the report coming out now?
Well, it's a result of a court order calling on the Army to release a police report after a lawsuit filed by American Oversight, which pushes for the release of government records. The report leaves a lot of questions, though. It's dated August 29th. All names are removed. Doesn't say whether Trump staffers were interviewed by police. It just indicates an altercation Port says the words "with both hands" attempted to move past, says his staffer did not require medical attention, filed a sworn statement, and did not press charges. The report says, by the way, the investigation continues. So what happened here was after Trump laid the wreath, he and his aides went to Section 60 of the cemetery, reserved for those from the Iraq and Afghan wars. But the Trump team brought their own photographers and videographers, and that's not allowed.
Right.
Only official cemetery photographers. So this employee was shoved aside by these aides, and campaign photos and videos were taken.
At the time, Tom, what did the Trump campaign have to say about all this?
Well, they said they were invited to Section 60 by Gold Star families, those who lost loved ones in that terrorist bombing. And they said the cemetery employee had a mental breakdown, which the Army strongly denied, and said the employee was abruptly pushed aside. Then Donald Trump went on to say it was a made-up story, which, of course, a police report indicates it was not. It was a campaign issue for a time. Kamala Harris, her supporters, and some military officials, former military officials, said it all showed the Trump campaign's disrespect for the cemetery.
Interesting developments, Tom. So is this the end of all this?
Well, you know, we're not sure. The report says the employee declined to press any charges, so there's no sense of any court action, let's say. Through a source back in August, NPR did identify the Trump staffers, Justin Caparole and Michael Picard, who did not respond to emails. Trump spokesman Stephen Chung did, and he just said Trump was there to support Gold Star families.
NPR's Tom Bowman, thanks.
You're welcome.
The name Belle DaCosta Green might not ring a bell, but New York's renowned historic Morgan Library and Museum is trying to change that. A new exhibit called A Librarian's Legacy opens today, just in time for the Morgan's 100th anniversary. It traces Green's life and her lasting influence as the library's first director and collector. It was an unusually prominent role for a woman at the time, a woman who chose to pass as white to survive in a highly segregated America. The Morgan Library was built and founded by J. Pierpont Morgan, one of the richest and most powerful bankers in the early 20th century. It houses a one-of-a-kind collection of medieval writings, rare books, and illuminated manuscripts, thanks in large part to Belle DaCosta Green. Erica Chilella is an exhibit curator for A Librarian's Legacy at the Morgan Library, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about Belle Green.
Oh, well, we're so excited to have you. So just explain, first of all, like, how did Belle DaCosta Green come to be associated with the Morgan Library in the first place?
Yeah, so she just was working as a librarian at Princeton University and really caught the attention of a gentleman by the name of Junius Morgan, who was an associate librarian there and just happened to be the nephew of Pierpont Morgan, who was at this time in the city wondering what to do with his amazing collection he had already started to collect and was unfortunately just kind of everywhere in his home. And he decided to build a library next door to his townhouse on Madison, and he needed a librarian to run it. And Junius said, "I think I have the perfect person for you." And in 1905, she began working for Pierpont Morgan as his librarian, cataloging his collection, and eventually stewarding this amazing building that we have and are celebrating still today.
I love that. I want to talk a little bit about her personal story, because Green, I mean, she was a black woman, but she didn't live her life publicly as a black woman. She chose to pass as white. Can you talk about that? Like, why she felt she had to do that? How did she do that? Please tell me more.
Yes, of course. I mean, the decision to pass was actually a family choice, and it was really spearheaded by her mother, Genevieve, who not only made the decision for all of Green and her siblings to pass, but did it fairly early on when Green was still in school. She had lived in Washington, D.C. She had lived previously in South Carolina and really saw the struggles of what it meant to be African-American in this country, what it was like during Reconstruction in the South. And so she really kind of knew that in order to move forward, sometimes you have to do what you have to do.
Did anyone ever suspect that she was not white? Do you know of any incident, any confrontation?
We do know that, like, newspaper reporters, they would always point out her dark hair or her wild hair or the darker skin color.
Her wild hair. Wow. And do you have any sense of what that did in the long term to her psyche, her identity, passing as white day to day for so much of her life?
She had a 10-volume set of diaries, and she does burn these before she passes away. But we do have a letter she wrote to the art historian Bernard Berenson, where she said that that is where she wrote things down that she dare not even think to herself. Mm. So what that means, unfortunately, we're never going to know. But I mean, it's got to have been a struggle. And I mean, it's actually incredible that she was made director as a woman.
Yeah.
I mean, most directors of these kinds of institutions were not women at this time either. So she had, you know, there's not only the racial issues she was up against, but the gender ones as well. I mean, she becomes director very shortly after women gained the right to vote. Mm. So, I mean, this is really a important time in American history to think of what women's rights in general were at this time and how much she was saying, I'm not going to conform to these ideals. I'm going to be my own person.
That's so cool. How would you characterize her larger legacy outside of the Morgan Library, looking back on all of this?
She really believed in accessing a collection, being able to use a collection, that it shouldn't just sit on a shelf, that she really wanted people to interact with that. And that's something that librarians today hold dear, but it wasn't the trend back then. And she really was a trailblazer for a special collection being used and not just something pretty you look at, but what can we learn from it? How do we access it? And that everyone, she really believed that everyone should have access to these materials, not just the super wealthy. And I think that is really a testament to her and the legacy she leaves behind to a much more larger library community.
I can't wait to check this out. Erica Chilella, an exhibit curator for A Librarian's Legacy, the Morgan Library's exhibit on its first ever director and librarian, Belle DaCosta Green. It opens today in New York. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Erica.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From C3 AI, C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. From San Jose State University, with 100-plus graduate and research programs ranging from AI to wildfire science, their graduates and their ideas are working to fuel innovation in Silicon Valley and beyond. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
Hi, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv, Ukraine. Wherever the story takes us, NPR does whatever it takes to get the story right. This is NPR.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org. Or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from KU's Spencer Museum of Art, now showing the exhibition Native Fashion, celebrating wearable artworks created by indigenous people historically and today. Details at spencerart.ku.edu.
Hope you'll stay tuned to KPR following the news for a live broadcast from the Lawrence Public Library featuring violinist Destiny Ann Mermagan and friends. A night of spooky sounds for Halloween, wrapping up KPR's annual live day. It's going to be a corker, and it is coming up in just about 5 minutes here on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center, presenting Mariachi Arencia de Mexico on October 26th. The new generation of mariachi takes the stage for a night of Mexican music. More at jccc.edu/mtc.
Mostly clear skies tonight with a low in the mid-30s. Tomorrow, sunshine and a high in the mid-60s. This is KPR, our live day concert coming up immediately following the news, which is next. It's 7:01.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. There are reports of explosions in the Iranian capital and the nearby city of Karaj tonight. In a statement, the Israeli Defense Forces say they're conducting, quote, precise strikes on military targets in Iran. General Hagari is lead spokesman for the IDF.
The regime in Iran and its proxies in the region have been relentlessly attacking Israel since October 7th on seven fronts, including direct attacks from Iranian soil. Like every other sovereign country in the world, the state of Israel has the right and the duty to respond.
Israel has been planning a response to a ballistic missile barrage carried out by Iran earlier this month. Iran, for its part, has warned any strike will be met by a stronger retaliation. As Vice President Kamala Harris tries to court moderate Republicans, some in the left flank of the Democratic Party are anxious she is leaving votes on the table. More from NPR's Asma Khalid.
In these final days of the election, Harris has been sounding the alarms about a second possible Donald Trump presidency and the danger to democracy. She's also touting support from Republicans, and that all makes some progressive Democrats wary.
I don't think that argument will seal the deal.
Joseph Givargis is the director of the group Our Revolution that spun out of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential run.
I think voters are looking for an economic message, and that should be the closing argument.
When asked about this concern by a reporter, Harris said that Americans can hold many thoughts at once. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
Well, pocketbook issues are always big in election years. Democratic strategist James Carville famously said it's the economy, stupid, during Bill Clinton's campaign, perhaps even more so this time. In Pittsburgh, people like Eudora Diamond have seen egg prices rise by 40% since last year, which is why she supports former President Trump.
Even though he believes in the trickle-down effect, I just know how it was when he was in office. Financially, I was much better.
In Pittsburgh's Hazelwood area, Bruce Thornton and his wife Emily own a juice bar, and while also struggling with higher prices, he's going the other way.
The reason why she's getting my vote is because I think it'll be a little bit, maybe a little better, I don't know, for us than the alternative.
Pennsylvania, meanwhile, remains a toss-up, as does the race nationally, less than 2 weeks from Election Day. Two more members of the Los Angeles Times editorial board say they are resigning after the paper's owner blocked its plan to endorse Democrat Kamala Harris for president. Two veteran journalists, Robert Greene and Karen Klein, announcing their resignations today. A similar announcement by the Washington Post has prompted consternation at that paper, a decision reportedly made by billionaire owner Jeff Bezos. Stocks lost some ground on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 259 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio.
Stardate October 25th. The moon goes face-to-face with a lion early tomorrow. At first light, Regulus, Leo's brightest star, stands close to the lower right of the moon, and a star in the lion's mane is a little farther to the left of the moon. It's part of the curving pattern of stars known as the sickle. Algeba is about 125 light-years away. It's the fourth brightest star in the constellation, and like Regulus, there's a lot more to it than meets the eye. It consists of two stars plus one known planet. The stars are separated by hundreds of times the distance from Earth to the Sun, so it takes centuries for them to orbit each other. Both stars are giants. They're much bigger and brighter than the Sun. That tells us that both stars are late in life. They've burned through the hydrogen fuel in their cores. Now they may be burning the helium ash created by that process. That's caused their outer layers to puff up. The heavier star has one confirmed planet. It was discovered 15 years ago. A study last year said it's at least 11 times the mass of Jupiter, the giant of our own solar system. That means it's likely a big ball of gas, probably with a small core of rock and metal. The planet is a bit farther from the star than Earth is from the Sun. At that range, the top of its atmosphere should be hot and turbulent. But so far, there haven't been any follow-up studies to tell us more about this giant planet in the Lion's Mane. You can find out about McDonald Observatory visitor programs at mcdonaldobservatory.org. And for the McDonald Observatory, I'm Billy Henry.
Support for Stardate on KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello, Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu. We're back to the Lawrence Public Library live next on Kansas Public Radio.
From the Lawrence Public Library, welcome to Live Day 2024, a celebration of classical music in live performances throughout the day. For Kansas Public Radio, I'm Daryl Brogdon. KPR's Live Day is made possible by the Jim Seaver Classical Music Fund. Dedicated in memory of Dr. Jim Seaver, the longtime host of Opera's My Hobby, this fund contributes to KPR classical music performances and ensures local music is accessible to everyone in our community. Help secure classical music is a cornerstone of KPR programming by becoming a contributing member to the Jim Seaver Classical Music Fund. Make a gift of support at kansaspublicradio.org. Tonight, we've got some spooky sounds for Halloween to close out this year's Live Day. So, without further ado, please welcome Destiny Ann Mermagan and friends.
Friends, and welcome to a very spooky version of Evening Classical and Live Day. I am your host, Destiny, but tonight I am a very different kind of host. I'm going to take you on a journey of a very special cast of characters of Halloween that meet a very special ghost. But this ghost has quite the fate in mind for them. Let's begin with the witches and the pumpkins. And now the giggling goblins are here as they prepare the way for the ghostly ghouls to appear. Ghosts are here. Do you hear them?
Yes.
Good job. These aren't just any ghosts. They're magpies, and they attempt to summon a very special ghost from his grave.
bell doth toll as the end of the night nears, and this special ghost begins to break out of his coffin. Thank you, Ike. I'm having a hard time not cracking up at some of this. Who is this special ghost? Why? It's Johann Sebastian Bach. He has risen from the grave, and he's here to send the cast of characters of Halloween back to theirs. We call this the debacle. Bach is here, and the cast of characters of Halloween have met their fate. Death. I know they're already dead, but they're dead again. Why? They stole all of Bach's Halloween candy. And so, in a low blood sugar rampage, he murdered them all. And now we're going to attend their funeral. Thank you.
For historical purposes, Bach was not actually a murderer. But never fear, even in death, we can have moments of peace and sweetness. Get it? Halloween candy? Thank you. It's a terrible joke. Am I fired? Now, it is time to woo our lovely spirits off to dreamland with a lullaby of the spirits.
Thank you.
So much, everyone. That was our little Halloween suite that we put together. We did a version of it last year, and it was such a big hit that we decided to bring it back. I have to tell you, we've got quite a few haunting tunes coming up, but I promise you the finale is crazy, so just buckle up for that. I'm going to introduce you to this wonderful cast of characters up here. First, we're actually going to start with John. He makes this Halloween suite such a treat. He actually added all of this percussion to it himself. He's great. Yes. He's fantastic. So I was hoping you could tell us about your toys. Tell us what your website is so we can all stalk you afterwards. That would be great.
Sure. JohnCurry.com, it's C-U-R-R-E-Y, all one word, JohnCurry.com, and that's kind of my percussion page there. And, you know, Halloween is a super fun time, as you have already heard, for percussionists, because we get to make a lot of the atmospheric, all the scary, spooky sounds and that sort of thing. It's kind of what Foley artists used to do, like in movies and cartoons and things like that, add all the different sound effects and atmospheric things before computers and all kind of digital took that over. But some of the fun stuff I get to play back here includes this instrument right here. It's called a vibraslap. Right? Yeah. The ghostly sounds comes from what we call a flexitone. Kind of like a miniature, you know, playing a miniature saw of sorts. So, but yeah, that's the ghostly sounds. One of my favorites is the thunder tube here. Yeah. Get the goblins kind of rattling, the skeletons rattling around with some shells strung on a stick. Yeah. And of course, we have to have a little enchantment with an instrument. You kind of generically call them wind chimes, but it's technically called a Mark tree. That's because the story is someone named Mark came up with it in a studio for recording it one time. And then, of course, the favorite of all is this thing right here, which is called the Aztec Death Whistle. Supposedly, I mean, it's fashioned after the originals that they say would capture the screams of the virgins that were sacrificed to the gods there, and that's what you're hearing on the originals. This is a replica, of course, but... I've gone out at night on Halloween night, late at night when people are trick-or-treating and just about done, and just like stood in the backyard and just played it a few times, kind of scared them. But yeah, otherwise some traditional percussion, and you get to hear some marimba here in just a little bit. But that's a little bit about what I'm playing for you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank
Destiny.
You.
So.
John is great, and he's such a treat to work with. And you know, you all are super important treats too. I'm so bad with the jokes. Jeez. It's terrible segues. I wanted to thank, first of all of you for being here, because your presence is going to help convince my wonderful boss to do this again next year, especially if you donate. We would like to thank On the Rocks, our sponsors, Eileen's Cookies, and Dr. Stephen H. Chronister of Healing Smiles for making it possible. And those of you that are already members, we really appreciate you. You keep us on the air, and we love doing it for you. So we are going to continue our Halloween journey with something, a piece of music that has been dedicated to Kansas Public Radio. If any of you have listened to my shows, who here has heard my shows? Okay, so sometimes you know I have really strange themes because my mind is very strange. Well, I was very curious one of these recent evenings, you know, what it would be like to sleep or live in a coffin, because that's what I do. I think of these things. So I did a Google search, an extensive one, and, well, wouldn't you know, I came up with a piece of music called Musical Box of Bones, written by Carolyn the Cello Doll, originally for cello and piano, and I listened to it, and I was like, this is cool. So I reached out to her and I asked her if she would consider writing it for this group of fine folks up here. And so she did. I know, it's about 3 minutes long and you are going to get to hear it. This is a premiere dedicated to Kansas Public Radio by the Cello Doll, A Musical Box of Bones. That's neat, isn't it? Yeah. Now that you're all imagining your life inside of a coffin, it's not so bad.
It's Halloween. I have to be kind of scary. We're ready for some serious classical music now. Classical music is serious. I try to make it fun. But we cannot have a Halloween concert without the most famous movement from Beethoven's piano trio, the Ghost Trio. But before we play that, we are so lucky to have a fine pianist here, Hyun Soon, and I'm going to have her come up and tell you what it's like living with me for a week.
So Mike and I go way back. We were students together at Juilliard, and we always had a good time, and we played together even then. And I had no idea that Mike could grow up to be such a fine cook. So I really, really love his cooking. And Destiny can cook too. But, you know, I'm a dog person. I actually have a rescue pit bull mix, Callie, and she's about 80 pounds. But I just totally fell in love with her dogs. She's got cats. I told you I was a dog person. Okay, so, yeah, she and Mike have five cats, and they are Siberian cats, just beautiful. And out of those five, I love them all, but there is one that is just so special, Francois. And he's my boyfriend, actually. He's just so cute, great personality, just so beautiful, and just so playful. Yeah, so I actually come to see him more than anything else.
Thank you. Oh, boy, the secret's out. Now you know just how many cats I have. Whoops, don't tell our HOA. I know some of you are very familiar with this great story that my darling husband Mike is about to tell you, but many of you haven't heard it, and it's the funniest story ever. No pressure.
Why do you make me do this one every time?
Because it's funny.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the most interesting things about traveling with a cello is everyone wonders, well, do you buy a ticket for it when you fly? And yes, the answer is yes. And many people don't know that, though, so when they see the case in a seat, they're like, but they didn't let me take my carry-on. Why is his cello in that seat? So there's a lot of hostility when you travel. And anyway, the story is that I was flying back from the Aspen Music Festival back to my apartment in New York, and so I went from Aspen to Denver, and in the Denver airport, I was heading to the next gate with the cello on my back like a backpack. I was hustling along, and I heard someone say from the Starbucks line, "Excuse me, is that a cello that you're carrying?" Now, being from New York, I normally pretend I'm deaf, and I just keep on walking, but for some reason, I decided to turn around and say, Yes, that's a cello. And then I started to go back on my way, and then she said, but are you Yo-Yo Ma? And at that point, I stopped dead in my tracks, and I turned around and said, yes. I am Yo-Yo Ma. And I'm a little fuzzy on what happened next. There might have been a selfie in there. I'm just not sure.
Wow. You finally made it. You made it to the top. You're Yo-Yo. Oh, boy. All right. This next, I don't know what to call it. It's just so much more than a piece of music. It's the middle movement to Beethoven's Ghost Trio. And Beethoven loved Shakespeare. And he was actually in conversations with the opera Macbeth and composing at that time. His most famous piano student, Beethoven's most famous piano student, says that this particular movement reminded Beethoven of the ghost of Hamlet's father. I know, so it's very haunting. It's a solid classical music piece. It's 10 minutes, so you might be a little scared, but it's beautiful and it's magical, and there are some great moments. It's just probably one of my favorite things by Beethoven to play. So I hope you enjoy it. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, our Halloween story continues. Now I feel very haunted after that. Hopefully you do too. This is one of my favorite things about performing, including cute youth. And it's actually so important to me that I started a nonprofit called Prairie Classical just to do that with performances and include youth alongside professionals so they actually get a chance to share the stage and play with adults because we can't have all the fun. No. And in fact, shameless plug, if you want to hear a different Halloween show tomorrow night, you can go to my website, destinyviolin.com, and find out where it's at. It's at 7:30 p.m. at Pine Ridge Presbyterian. So it's another Halloween show, another set of youth. It's going to be really great. So speaking of being haunted, we have this very neat little tune coming right. Haunted House. And I hear that Wednesday Addams is in the house. Hi, Wednesday Addams, also known as Eloise McPhee. Would you like to come up? Yay! Let's give her a round of applause. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
How old are you?
I'm 9.
She's 9 years old. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. So, she happened to be working on this lovely tune called Haunted House, and in the middle of it, there is a little section called a cadenza. And a cadenza is something where the violinist gets to make up their own thing. And I tasked her with making up some really spooky sounds. Since I've been telling so many bad jokes, Eloise is actually here to save the day with a really cute one. Do you have a joke you'd like to share?
Yeah. When is it actually bad luck to be followed by a black cat?
When?
When you're a mouse.
Oh, very good. Much better than my jokes. I think they liked it. All right, so we are going to do our little Haunted House duet for you, and I'm going to put this microphone back and get my instrument first. That was amazing. Your public Kansas Public Radio debut, Eloise McPhee. Hooray! All right. Well, I don't know. I mean, the show should just be over at that point. We do have a grand finale for you. I know we've had a lot of haunted, spooky sounding things, but this is pretty wild. It is Sasson's Danse Macabre. Yes, I'm sure you've heard it many times already this season, but this version's very unique because it's a creation that the three of us came up with. Well, you know, we added to it. So, Danse Macabre, I figured this would fit into the Halloween story because, you know, we just heard from the haunted house and now the ghosts are all back, they're out of their coffins, and we need to send them back to their graves. And so that's kind of what Danse Macabre is about. It's about the ghosts coming out to dance, and then at the very end, the bell actually doth toll, and then they go back. So see, it's like it's a whole thing, it's a whole story. Yeah, great, okay. I really hope you enjoy it. This is going to be super fun. So thank you so much again to Kansas Public Radio for having us, and to my darling husband, Mike. It's the nicest thing I've said all day. To John and Hyunsoon and everyone else for being here. Thank you.
was Destiny and Mermaidin and Friends, featuring cellist Michael Mermaidin, Yunsun Wong at the piano, and percussionist John Curry, with special guest Eloise McPhee. Our broadcast engineers are Jason Sloat and Chuck Smith. Production assistance by Jeff Watson, Emily DeMarchi, Amber Nickel, Kay McIntyre, and Joanna Fewins. Live Day is produced by Cordelia Brown. KPR's Live Day is made possible by contributions to the Jim Seaver Classical Music Fund, supported by the generous gifts of Don Marquis and our community of KPR listener members. Learn how to contribute to local classical music at kansaspublicradio.org. I'm Darryl Brogdon. Happy Halloween, and so long from the Lawrence Public Library.
Bye!
The winner of our costume contest is the Thunderheads. We have your prize over there. Thank you all for coming. Have a wonderful night.
Support for Live Day on Kansas Public Radio comes from Topeka's Noto Arts and Entertainment District, featuring a celebration of souls, Day of the Dead in southern Mexico. Exploring the Dia de los Muertos holiday traditions and origins. Now till December 14th. Information at explorenoto.org. And Green Lady Lounge, featuring Kansas City jazz music, cocktails, wine, and beer. Live Kansas City jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. Information at greenladylounge.com. We're live, we're local. We are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We are KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. And we're always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for being with us on a Friday evening. I hope you've enjoyed today's KPR Live Day events in the KPR Performance Studio and at the Lawrence Public Library. At 9 tonight, we'll have jazz with Bob McWilliams between now and then. Thought I might be able to give you a little bit of taste, little bit of a taste of Film Music Friday with some suitably spooky selections. First from Bernard Herrmann and his great collaboration with the master of horrific cinema, Alfred Hitchcock. We'll listen to a suite from the film Psycho next with the City of Prague Philharmonic, led by Patrick Bateman on Kansas Public Radio. The City of Prague Philharmonic, conducted by Patrick Bateman. Music by Bernard Herrmann, who chilled a lot of spines back in the day, raking the strings the way he did over the violins in the score to the Alfred Hitchcock horror classic, Psycho, here on Kansas Public Radio. The time is about 8:15, and still to come, we'll have along the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra with a few selections from horror movies, such as The Bride of Frankenstein and Poltergeist by Jerry Goldsmith. Support for Kansas Public Radio comes from Bob Schwartz Financial, helping Kansans make informed financial decisions for their families for over 45 years. More at bobschwartzfinancial.com. And the Midwest Trust Center, presenting Hyperprov, starring Colin McCree and Asad Mickey, Sunday evening, November 3rd, combining hypnosis and improv for a totally unique live comedy experience. Details at jccc.edu/mtc. For tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, sky should be mostly clear. We'll have low temperatures in the upper 30s. Sunny tomorrow with a high in the mid-60s. For tomorrow night, partly cloudy, lows in the lower 40s. Next on KPR, here's something quite interesting by Philip Glass. Philip Glass and the Kronos Quartet were commissioned by Universal Studios Home Entertainment back in 1999 to come up with a new score for the re-release of their 1931 classic, Bela Lugosi's Dracula. We'll hear pianist Bruce Livingston with a few piano arrangements of some choice selections from Glass's score to Dracula next on Kansas Public Radio. Thank you. At the keyboard, Bruce Levinson, and piano selections from the score To Dracula, composed by Philip Glass and the Kronos Quartet for the 1999 DVD release of the Bela Lugosi classic, here on Kansas Public Radio. It is 8:27. Thanks for joining us on a Friday evening. Support for classical music on KPR comes from Liberty Hall in downtown Lawrence, with more than 11,000 files on DVD and Blu-ray available to rent, from classics to cult, open daily from 1 to 9 p.m. A browsable inventory is online at libertyhall.net. The Kansas City Jazz Orchestra is going to bring the swing on Saturday night, December 14th, at KPR's annual Big Band Christmas Concert at Liberty Hall. What better way to kick off the holiday season than with some big band favorites and Christmas songs? Tickets are on sale now at Liberty Hall and at Ticketmaster.com. You can find out more at that website, kansaspublicradio.org. We'll join the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra, led by Eric Kunzel, for a few selections from different movies. We'll start with music by Franz Waxman, who got a big break in 1935 after meeting the director James Whale, director of Bride of Frankenstein. The music that Waxman tuned in for that movie was so successful it earned him an appointment as head of music at Universal Studios. Here's the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra on Kansas Public Radio. That was Jerry Goldsmith. The Light, music from the film Poltergeist. And before that, we heard music from The Bride of Frankenstein by Franz Waxman, both selections performed by the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra, led by Eric Kunzel, here on Kansas Public Radio, where it is 8:37. Support for Kansas Public Radio comes from the Topeka Symphony, presenting Puttin' on the Ritz with Rimsky-Korsakov's Procession of the Nobles and Grieg's Piano Concerto performed by Cheung Park on Saturday, November 2nd. Tickets at TopekaSymphony.org and Green Lady Lounge, offering Kansas City Jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. Green Lady Lounge is located at 1809 Grand Boulevard, Kansas City. Information at greenladylounge.com. We'll go back very early into the world of cinema, to the era of the silent picture, and hear something for you by composer J.S. Zamishnik, who was a student of Antonin Dvorak and wrote a lot of the sort of music used in early silent films. We'll hear a few selections from the type of sound when a scene became too dramatic, too heavy, or perhaps even a touch horrifying. The Montalto Motion Picture Orchestra, with music by J.S. Zamishnik, next on KBR.
Thank you.
from the Monte Alto Motion Picture Orchestra, with a few selections from composer J.S. Zamyshnik from the days of the silent picture. We listened to A Gruesome Tale, followed by Storm Music, here on KPR, where it's 8:45, 15 minutes to go until news from NPR at the top of the hour, followed by jazz with Bob McWilliams. And as it turns out, there's actually not that much film music about scary movies in the KPR Music Library, as I'd assumed. So we'll leave you with pianist Paul Jacobs, with music by William Bokum for piano, Three Ghost Rags, on KPR. Thank you.
Thank you.
Graceful Ghost, Poltergeist, and Dream Shadows, Three Ghost Rags by William Bolcom, played by pianist Paul Jacobs. It's 9 p.m., and NPR News just ahead, followed by Jazz with Bob McWilliams. I'm Jeb Watson. Hope you have a great rest of your evening. We're live, we're local. Kansas Public Radio is KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, and KANQ Chanute. Support for news on KPR comes from Green Lady Lounge, featuring Kansas City jazz music, cocktails, wine, and beer. Live Kansas City jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. Information at greenladylounge.com. And the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu. This is Kansas Public Radio.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. After saying for weeks it would retaliate for an Iranian ballistic missile attack earlier this month, Israel appears to be following through on that promise. There have been at least two waves of explosions over the Iranian capital, Tehran, in the past few hours. NPR's Jackie Northam says while expected, it also further ramps up tensions in the Mideast.
It wasn't unexpected. Most analysts thought it would have happened several weeks ago, in fact. And the U.S. has been very involved in trying to make sure that Israel did not retaliate by hitting Iran's nuclear energy installations. Oil is a key driver of Iran's economy, and it could have had repercussions worldwide. The problem, of course, is that the two countries could get into this, you know, tit-for-tat situation where it's uncertain where it would end. And, you know, it could lead to some sort of miscalculation and, you know, leading into a broader regional war, which could pull in the U.S.
NPR's Jackie Northam. Militant group Hamas, backed by Tehran, carried out a terror attack on Israel more than a year ago, starting a brutal war in Gaza. U.S. officials say Russia manufactured a fake video that purports to show someone destroying ballots marked for former President Trump in Pennsylvania. NPR's Shannon Bond reports Russian propagandists have made other phony videos targeting the Democratic ticket.
Federal intelligence officials and the FBI say Russia is behind the video, which is spread widely on social media, including Elon Musk's X. The video was quickly debunked by local election officials and the district attorney's office in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. They say the envelopes and ballots shown are not what the county uses to vote. Federal officials say the fake video is part of Russia's efforts to undermine confidence in the integrity of the election and stoke division among Americans. The video was posted by an X account that previously shared another video making false accusations against Democratic vice presidential nominee Tim Walz. Intelligence officials have said that was also a Russian fake. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
According to a new study, more abortions are being performed across the country now than before Roe v. Wade was overturned, but a few states are bucking that trend. Elizabeth Caldwell from member station KWGS has more.
The hashtag WeCount report shows a small increase in monthly abortions nationwide. Only three states with bans, Idaho, Texas, and Oklahoma, saw actual declines. Dr. Ushma Upadhyay with the University of California, San Francisco, says the decrease indicates unmet need.
We believe that it's people who are most disenfranchised, most, left out of the healthcare system, people living in poverty, people with low access to digital resources.
Researchers say they're waiting for federal data on births to paint a fuller picture. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Caldwell in Tulsa.
Stocks gave up some of their gains to close mixed today. The Dow down 259 points. You're listening to NPR. The man who helped anchor the sound of the psychedelic jam band The Grateful Dead has died. Bassist Phil Lesh provided some of the soaring harmonies on the group's most popular songs. As a founding member of the group, he also co-wrote songs including St. Stephen and Dark Star. Phil Lesh was 84 years old. A federal judge is blocking a major fashion merger of companies that own Coach, Kate Spade, and Michael Kors brands. NPR's Lena Siliuk reports the deal was worth $8.5 billion.
The two companies that want to merge are Tapestry, which makes Coach and Kate Spade, and the other is Capri Holdings, which owns the brands Versace, Jimmy Choo, and Michael Kors. The Federal Trade Commission sued to stop their deal, arguing these are the main companies that make affordable luxury bags, especially Kate Spade and Michael Kors brands, which would go from rivals to one parent company. Now, a U.S. district judge has agreed with the FTC, saying this merger should not proceed because it would reduce head-to-head competition, likely raising prices for shoppers. The companies argue the ruling is wrong in its understanding of just how competitive the fashion world is, and they plan to appeal. Alina Selyukh, NPR News.
Attention, Kmart shoppers. Actually, never mind. There aren't many of you left. The company that once had more than 2,000 stores domestically now has just one. The sole surviving Kmart in the U.S. located in a suburban Miami shopping mall. Put out of business by nimbler rivals like Walmart, Target, and Amazon, the Miami store became the last Kmart this week. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.